AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Top class actions alert. In a groundbreaking move for the payment industry, Visa and MasterCard have come to a historic $5.6 billion settlement. Top class actions is connecting business owners who accepted Visa or MasterCard from January 1st, 2004 to January 25th, 2019 to their share of this $5.6 billion settlement. Claim your share today at topclassactions.com/visa. That's topclassactions.com/visa.
Can you hear that? That's the sound of your engine building up damaging deposits. You know, the kind that hurt fuel economy, performance, and the longevity of your engine. And unfortunately, it starts the moment you drive it off the lot. So no matter the age of your vehicle, it's building up deposits. But here's the good news. There's a new motor oil that removes up to 100% of deposits. Introducing Valvoline Restore and Protect. It's the first and only motor oil that restores pistons to factory clean by removing up to 100% of deposits. That's right, 100%. Restoring your engine to run like new. Plus, Valvoline Restore and Protect is a premium full synthetic that features 79% greater wear protection than industry standards. And with continuous use, it even keeps new deposits from forming. So if you like how a new engine performs, you're going to love new Restore and Protect. Another first from Valvoline.
Hear that? The Queen City's calling you. Charlotte is an oasis of culinary adventure waiting to be explored. As bold flavors excite your taste buds, unexpected menus spark your curiosity, and epic rooftop views ignite your senses. From whitewater rapids to heights that defy the laws of gravity, a new thrill is found around every corner. But no matter where you find yourself in Charlotte, you'll instantly find yourself at home. Plan your trip at charlottesgotalot.com.
It's the Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Good morning. The Back Nine Boys Golf Show podcast is brought to you by Clubcar, leader in sport, utility, and personal vehicles, by Bridgestone. Try the new Tour B ball today, by the club at Sea Palms, by RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community, and by CJ's, Italian restaurant, home of the deep dish and thin crust pizzas. Check out their full menu at CJsItalianRestaurant.com. On the show, we're going to talk with Chubby Chandler, former agent for world number two, Rory McIlroy, about his thoughts on the so-called offer that Rory has been given and how the PGA Tour handled the situation with the LIV Tour and what Chubby thinks about that. Then we'll talk with Jeff Babineau, former Golf Digest writer, about the Bay Hill Invitational and what Mr. Palmer would be doing this week during the tournament. And we're going to talk with CEO of Global Golf Post, Jim Nugent, who will give us his thoughts on a variety of topics. And we want to welcome Jim in now. Good morning, Jim, and welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Good morning, Rich, and thank you for having me on today.
It's always a pleasure because we have kind of a eclectic view of a lot of things, and we talk about a lot of different topics. But give me your thoughts on the so-called offer to Rory that has just put a lot of people up in arms about golf.
Well, I don't think that Rory has received, I take that back. I don't think Rory has seriously considered an offer to join LIV Golf. I suspect he's probably had an offer, maybe more than one. But all along, he was pretty steadfast that he was staying with the tour, and he was deeply involved with Tiger and others to try and bring unity to the game. What I do think is happening, though, is that he is about to sign a corporate partnership with a company somewhere in the Middle East. either in Saudi Arabia or a company that has extensive business dealings with Saudi Arabia, but it's not going to entail or involve him leaving the PGA Tour to go and play LIV Golf.
And do you think that Rory was treated fairly by the tour? Or do you think the tour kind of pulled the rug out from under him on some of the things that have been going on?
Well, I'm conflicted on that. Yeah, the communication was very poor, and Jay Monahan said as much. But, you know, this is bigger than golf, bigger than sport, bigger than the PGA Tour. Early on, the dialogue that was taking place with Ed Herlihy and Jimmy Dunn, who were on the board of the PGA Tour, this is more akin to international diplomacy than it is sport. They were doing what they thought was the right thing at the time. They were acting with the best interests of the tour in mind. It wasn't perceived that way. The rollout was very poor. And certainly a couple of key players like Rory should have been given better notice, not necessarily brought into the conversation because they didn't add a lot at that moment, but they should have been given a better heads up than they received.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. Let's talk a little bit about John Rahm. I mean, not only him going to LIV, which for the money that he was offered, a lot of people probably would not blame him, but now he's come back and he's attacking Rory, where Rory was standing up for John, saying, you know, after John left for LIV, we've got to let him play in the Ryder Cup and all this other kind of stuff. And then John put something up on social media about the only way Rory's going to get to a champion's dinner at the Masters is to be a waiter. Kind of a low blow.
Rich, I saw that. I don't really believe that that came from John Rahm. If it did, I'm more disappointed in him than I was, and I'm already very disappointed in him. But I've learned the hard way, you got to be real careful about what you see in social media. I think that would be really out of character for John Rahm to have done that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Why are you disappointed with John? For going?
Yeah, because I took him at his word. And, you know, I thought of him as an upstanding citizen, obviously a great player. He pledged fealty, to use his own expression, I think. And then he got bought off. And I was very, very disappointed. Most of the other guys that left, I wasn't really going to miss them. I didn't really care much one way or another. But Rahm, that one stung a little bit. And I'll never look at him the same way. I'll respect his golf game, but I won't have a lot of use for him personally.
Yeah. What do you hear about the PGA Tour and LIV getting together? I mean, do you really think that they're going to do that? Or what do you see in the future for the two tournaments?
Well, if I knew, I'd be on every golf talk radio show in the world this morning.
I know.
The reality is I'm nobody's really close to it. I'm hopeful. But as it's been said so often, hope is not a strategy. So I'm not sure that it's going to happen. And as time goes on, I become more concerned. If we don't get news of progress, substantive progress, next week at the Players' Championship when Jay Monahan conducts his usual press conference, if that doesn't happen, then I suspect the deal's not going to happen.
How do you feel about the SSG $3 billion investment, which includes a variety of folks from the Boston Red Sox to, NBA players and that investment into the PGA Tour?
I feel very positive about it, and I can elaborate on that. Just a couple of weeks ago, after the deal was announced, a number of SSG representatives, I don't know who and how many, went out to the Genesis event at Riviera in Los Angeles. And I heard from a couple of sources that they made a very positive impact on the players. The players were impressed by these guys, impressed by their vision, impressed by their commitment. And so the initial stages, it looks like things are going well. There's a long way to go, though, and these people are in the private equity business, and private equity is really good about one thing, many things, but one thing they're really good at is cutting costs. And I think you're going to start in the back half of this year to start to hear about cost cutting taking place in parts of the PGA Tour.
And that would probably mean their staff, their management?
I think they'll look at every aspect of the business to be sure, but certainly staffing is high on that list.
Yeah, and obviously they're going to want a a return on their investment, especially at the amount that they're putting into this. And how do you feel about how the tour has developed this kind of return on investment and involved the players?
Well, yeah, they certainly are going to be looking for a return sometime in the next 7 to 10 years. I think it's going to, you know, they're going to be looking to create new commercial businesses, new lines of business. And you can't just take, you know, the TV deal is baked. That's put to bed. You can't include that. So I think you're going to see the tour starting to take over more of their tournaments, as they did last week in Palm Beach. That's now owned and operated by the tour. I think you could see some acquisitions of businesses. It's not out of the question that they might not acquire the DP World Tour in its entirety. It could go in a number of directions, but they're looking to grow the business, to grow the top and bottom lines, so as to generate a meaningful return in the next decade or so.
Jim, some people have said, I mean, they've asked me, and obviously I don't know, but do you think the PGA Tour was in trouble money-wise since LIV has come onto the market?
Well, yes, in two ways. First of all, they were, and I think a tour executive used these words, they were bleeding money, not in the sense of losing money, but they were spending millions upon millions, tens of millions on legal fees, late in 22 and into 23 in a number of different venues, New York and San Francisco, I think, especially. That was a lot of money, just a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
And secondly, they were challenged all of a sudden when the purses, you know, the live purses got up to where they were, and that was attracting players. All of a sudden, the tour had to figure out, how do we take, you know, these sponsors from $15 or so million to 20 or 25. And that was a real challenge. And they had to do some of that themselves out of the reserves. It's still a challenge because there's not a lot. When they go to a sponsor, as they did Wells Fargo, and say, look, we need you to go from 20 to 25. And they're not offering a ton more value for that extra $5 million. That's a very difficult conversation to have.
Well, and now we have the elevated events, and I'm sure some of the sponsors of those elevated events, that's costing them, obviously, more money to be one of those, but they're not getting much more for it, or are they?
Well, that, you know, it's each case is different. Each tournament, each sponsor is different. This week is a signature event at Bay Hill, the Arnold Palmer Invitational. No one's exactly sure if MasterCard put more money out there, and if so, how much did they do and what did they get in return?
Right.
What is true is that the Palmer Invitational has a smaller field, a very, very small cut. The pro-ams didn't take place. So the economics of this particular tournament are very different and very challenging for MasterCard and for the PGA Tour.
So in the elevated events or the signature events, they are not doing pro-ams?
I don't know that that's across the board, but I do know that in the case of the Palmer Invitational, their Monday pro-am was eliminated, and I think the Wednesday pro-am is now voluntary by the players in the field.
Oh, wow. My feeling is that the golf fan has been hurt by the PGA Tour, the battle with LIV. What are your thoughts?
I don't know that I would agree with the word hurt. The word that I hear, and I wrote about this in Global Golf Post earlier this year, and it just keeps resonating, is disgust.
Okay.
Disgust at the to the degree that money has become what we're talking about, not performance, not legacy, not achievements. There's just a lot of disgust, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but I, you know, what you hear a lot of is, I'm not going to watch it much anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if the ratings reflect that or not. My eye test tells me that the galleries at a couple of the tournaments, particularly San Diego, have been smaller than usual. And what I heard last weekend, which was concerning, but consistent with what I'm hearing, is that pro golf right now runs the risk of becoming like pro tennis. There's a tournament every week, but nobody's particularly paying attention except in the local market. But four times a year, everybody gets excited about Wimbledon and the Australia Open and the U.S. Open and the French Open. And if that's what our game comes down to, that it's all about the four men's majors and not much else, that would not be a very good outcome for the pro game in America or around the world.
No, I totally agree with you on that, because when the fan now turns in, he's seeing names that they've never seen before, and I can't imagine that that's good for viewership.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that some of those names wouldn't have won anyhow. The guys that won, you know, they had really, really good weeks. And, you know, some of those fields were decent, not all of them.
Yeah.
I think it's just a coincidence that you had a run there of three or four guys that most people are scratching their head saying, well, that's not Rory or that's not Jordan Spieth. There's not a direct AB correlation there between unknown winners and the whole live world that we're in.
Jim, you mentioned money earlier and all this investment by the SSG group of $3 billion. Do you think it's gotten too much now on the PGA Tour about raising the purses, and it's too much about money and not enough for the love of the game and the competitiveness of the game?
Well, the narrative has certainly been that way. The conversation has been that way. You know, they're still playing competitive golf. They're still playing high-level golf. But it just seems to be overshadowed by the conversation about things taking place off the golf course, be it money or Norman or official world rankings. We're not focused on the golf the way that we were in 2021 or 2022. And that's disappointing. And I think for the tour, that's got to be concerning long run.
What do you think the future is for Jay Monahan?
I think Jay is going to be okay. I think he's going to keep his job. He's very close to the Fenway people. I'm told that the Fenway group or the SSG group, of which Fenway is a part of, there's a stipulation in there that he is to continue to be the commissioner of the PGA Tour. So I think rumors of his departure are off base at this moment in time.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I love talking about the variety of topics. You're not afraid to give me upfront, honest answers, and I love it. Thank you for being with us, and have a great day.
Rich, thanks for having me on this morning.
Hello, this is Chris Sack, the men's golf coach at the University of Georgia, and you're listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show.
And welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. Our next guest is good golfer, good guy, good dad, good husband, but he's also a former writer for Golf Digest, Jeff Babineau. Jeff, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Rich, good to be with you.
So you've been around a long time. I'm not saying that you're old, but you've been around a long time, you know, especially at Bay Hill when Arnie was alive. What was Bay Hill like when Arnie was alive?
It was great. You know, I count it as one of the real blessings of my career. I was the beat writer here at the Orlando Sentinel covering golf for a number of years. And, you know, Bay Hill was our big annual, you know, the one week a year the circus came to town.
Yeah.
And with Arnold there, it was just great because you'd have a great field. Back in the old days, it was one of the first times you'd see a lot of international players coming over and getting ready in the run-up to the Masters and the players. And so he had a great field. Arnold was around, and he just loved the competition. He loved seeing the golfers, meeting the younger guys. He loved getting the golf course as difficult as he could make it and testing all these guys, and just really built a great championship that's become a big part of this town.
Hear that? The Queen City's calling you. Charlotte is an oasis of culinary adventure waiting to be explored. As bold flavors excite your taste buds, unexpected menus spark your curiosity, and epic rooftop views ignite your senses. From whitewater rapids to heights that defy the laws of gravity, a new thrill is found around every corner. But no matter where you find yourself in Charlotte, you'll instantly find yourself at home. Plan your trip at charlottesgotalot.com.
And Arnie was very visible during the week of the tournament, wasn't he?
Arnold was everywhere. I remember the first year, what we lost Arnold, I think in 2016, and the next year, MasterCard, the sponsor of the tournament, appointed five ambassadors to kind of try to do some of the things Arnold would do during tournament week. And these five people ran themselves ragged trying to keep up with Arnold's schedule that he did by himself. And it just shows you he's everywhere. My wife and her friend came one year. She's not a big golf fan. They came to watch golf. And within 20 minutes, somehow they wrangled a picture with Arnold. And
Oh my
a lot of
God.
people could tell that story, right? He just happened to be one of those guys who seemed to be everywhere. And he certainly, yeah, he wasn't an absentee owner by any means. He owns the golf course. So back in the day, Winnie Palmer and Arnold, Winnie would take care of all the plants around the property, and that was a big pride point for her. And Arnold took care of the golf course, and they built it into one of the PGA Tour's great championships.
I met a guy in Savannah who had won a lot of amateur tournaments in Savannah and played in some events that Arnie was at. And he was supposed to go on a blind date. I know we're getting off the subject, but it's a great story. He was supposed to go on a blind date with this lady, and named Winnie. And she was coming down the stairs, and Arnie was coming from the opposite direction. And this guy from Savannah stood up and said, "Arnie, I want you to meet Winnie." And they ended up getting married, and he went wherever he went but that night. But I was so mesmerized by this story that this is the guy that introduced Winnie and Arnold together. Anyway.
Right. That was a great story. That was at the old Shawnee, I think it was called, up in, I think it was in Pennsylvania. And
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it was great. Just a great Arnold, such a great guy. I would try to get him on the phone to do a tournament preview, and he always made me drive out to Bay Hill, which is about a 45-minute drive, and interview him when he hit balls. I'd say, no, we're going to do it in person. I'm not doing it on the phone. So I'd drive out there and I'd go out to the back of the range. Arnold would be hitting balls. We'd talk about the tournament, the players, the early commitments. And what, I look at it now and how lucky was I to be able to do that. And he just loved golf so much. I went there on a Monday one time. The only two tour players on the premises were Corey Pavin, who at the time I think was the US Open champion, and Arnold. And Arnold was like regripping his own clubs, the old leather grips. And I saw him cut his thumb. He almost severed his thumb with his banana knife, trying to cut these grips off. And he was a constant tinker of equipment and trying out stuff. And he would drive around Bay Hill with two full staff bags full of clubs, trying out stuff. And that guy just loved golf. I mean, I would love to love the game the way Arnold Palmer loved golf, but he just had it in his heart.
Yeah, but you'd have to be able to play it like Arnie, and I would love golf if I could play half that well.
No doubt. No doubt. But he just loved being out there. He played in the daily shootout at Bay Hill. He was just another guy to all the members. It wasn't like royal, he was called the king, but it wasn't like royalty walking around. He was like another guy. He
Yeah.
always kept that the common man presence, and never put on airs or tried to be something that he really wasn't. He loved being a normal guy and having a beer and sitting back in the clubhouse and telling some stories.
Yeah, and he would walk around the clubhouse from what I've been told, and talk to people, walk through the lunchroom or dinner room or whatever, and just talk with folks.
I mean, I would see him at the end of the day, whatever shirt he was wearing would be absolutely covered in Sharpie marks from signing autographs all day. It was just amazing. He looked people in the eye. He had conversations. He recognized people that would come up to Bay Hill, several years in a row, things like that. And he taught a lot of the younger players to do these things. He taught them how to sign a clean, legible autograph. He taught Rocco Media. It was an old college buddy of mine. He taught him how to look people in the eye when he talked to them and listen to people. And it's really not that hard. Some of the things Arnold would do, he probably slapped his hat off my head for having a hat on doors. You know, he was the gentleman who never liked having anyone wear hats inside the clubhouse at Bay Hill. But it's just simple lessons, common things, simple things. And he just had that great touch.
But he had tremendous forearms and hands, didn't he?
He did. He really did. He had big, strong hands. You know, he drove a tractor. He mowed the fairways for his dad, Deacon, up at Latrobe, and drove this tractor and was explaining one time it had no power steering, this big monster tractor, and he would have to turn this thing around, head up and down fairways, and his legs were strong. And you saw it. If you went up to Latrobe, you saw the hills you had to walk, and you picture Arnold as a young kid walking those hills and driving that tractor and building his forearms and doing all the work that he did. And he was a strong, he was kind of a man's man, you know. He was a throwback kind of guy. Served a couple of years in the Coast Guard. Thought that was one of the most valuable stretches of his life. You know, he went there real suddenly when he left Wake Forest when a good friend of him was killed in a car accident. He up and joined the Coast Guard, and he looked at that, you know, served his country just as such a valuable time. And he just lived such a great life. What a special life.
Yeah, he really did. Did you ever go to Latrobe and see his warehouse?
I did. I went to the barn. Unbelievable. I went there with Alex Maselli. We took a drive, and Arnold's brother at the time, who has since passed, I think Jerry, took us around. It was a Hall of Fame in itself, and it was all in this red barn on property up there in Latrobe. You know, Arnold Palmer for President stickers and all his pins and all his Ryder Cup bags and live tractors in there and all the commercial things he had done. And you honestly could spend a full day in there. We might have spent an hour and just felt like we saw just a portion of it. It was amazing. Just all this, you know, as I say, like seeing all of those Ryder Cup bags and just, you got a feel for the experiences he had, his pilot stuff. He loved flying, just absolutely loved that. He had a passion for that, like he did for golf, and he had a lot of stuff in there as well. And it was a cool place. I know there's plans up there to kind of use that stuff in a museum type atmosphere. And I think it would be great because I think people just don't get enough of Arnold Palmer.
And he also saved all of his clubs, didn't he? Didn't he have every set of clubs that he'd ever clubs. Had?
Oh, man, he had a zillion clubs in his office up in Latrobe, his office right across the street from the club. He had to have a wall of 1,000 putters.
Oh, my
sitting
gosh.
There in the wall that he could go get all the clubs, all these – yeah, just cool knickknacks. Although, think of all the memorabilia he collected through the years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Mario Lemieux jerseys and baseball stuff from the Pirates and all the places he would go. All his world travels. I mean, it's underrated how he and Jack and Arnold, he and Jack and Gary Player would tour the world, you know, doing exhibitions, and they'd all hop in Arnold's plane and off they'd go to the next stop. And they really saw the world, you know, they'd be at the Australian Open and they'd be in Japan, and they would just, it really was, you know, we think of it today as a global game. I mean, they helped make it a global game and really spread the game across the globe. And, you know, Arnold Palmer had businesses all over the world. It's an amazing life. I mean, I could read 20 books on that guy and wait for the 21st.
Who do you think on the PGA Tour now makes you think about Arnold Palmer, or is there anyone?
This is where projects come to life. Our showrooms are designed to inspire with the latest products from top brands, curated in an inviting, hands-on environment, and a team of industry experts to support your project. We'll be there to make sure everything goes as planned, from product selection to delivery coordination. At Ferguson Bath, Kitchen, and Lighting Gallery, your project is our priority.
See the latest designs from your favorite brands, including Brizo, at your local Ferguson showroom.
Yeah, I mean, he did so much. I don't think any one person fills his shoes. I mean, the way, maybe with a respect for the game and how he acts, Jordan Spieth a little bit, Ricky a little bit, the way he treats the fans is a real fan favorite. But, you know, Jordan's won majors, but, you know, Arnold did this playing at the very top level, you know, winning majors and winning open championships. He really jump-started getting the Americans back to the Open across the pond. We call it the British Open, but the Open Championship, going over to St. Andrews and winning at Royal Lytham and kind of, you know, reigniting Americans' interest in playing the game over there. And
yeah,
think nothing of it now when you see so many at the Open. But yeah, there's different. I think there's people that take parts of Arnold Palmer. There's a lot of younger players who got to spend time with him, valuable time, learn some things from him. But I don't think any one player could replace him.
It's kind of like a Michael Jordan. Who's the next Michael Jordan? There isn't one. There isn't
right.
one.
There's just an aura about him that it went beyond the golf shots he hit. And have won more championships.
Yeah.
Right? They won more tournaments. But they have an impact. I always call Arnold the most impactful golfer of all time, if not the greatest golfer. Just because of the impact he had and when he came along and how important that was in the development of golf.
Yeah, I got to meet him a couple of times, opened up a couple of golf courses, including the one up at NC State. Cordial, friendly, gracious, just a wonderful, wonderful person. So what is Bay Hill like now, Jeff, without Arnie?
Well, there was a big concern, you know, if you remember when Byron Nelson passed, I mean, his tournament suffered, the one that had his name on in Dallas, and there was fear the same might happen here in Orlando. I don't honestly think Bay Hill is – a lot of tour players aren't going to list it as their favorite golf course. It's some of it's a little bit repetitive design-wise. Some of it is just playing really, really hard. You know, if the wind blows out there, you have a lot of water to dodge out there, and it's difficult. I think three of the past four tournaments out there have been won single digits under par. So there was a big concern when Arnold wasn't here, it was going to lose a lot of its luster. But I think the tour has done a nice job. It brought in different players to MasterCard. It's done as well, whether it was Brant Snedeker, it was GMAC for a while. These guys, Justin Rose, I filled in as ambassadors. The tournament stayed in the hands of Arnold's family. You know, his son-in-law, Roy, and daughter help run the tournament now. And that's a big thing. And this week it's a signature event. So you have, I think, 69 players in the field, and you have all the best players on the PGA Tour. So, you know, you have a great field. So it's It's gone on nicely. I mean, they worried about it, but you know, it has a 3-year exemption for a winner instead of a 2-year. So little things they've done out there to keep it special, and because people know what that place meant to Arnold, I think it means something extra to the players too.
Yeah, we've got about 2 minutes. What was it like when you went to Bay Hill when you weren't on the range with him in the back, just you and him? What was it like walking into his office and seeing Arnie at his desk?
He was always there. I would always go up tournament week and take a walk. You'd go past the locker room, up these stairs, and guys would always drop in and see Arnold. But I would always pop in there and talk for a while and, you know, get some notes, talk about the tournament. But he would have a stack of things every day of his life that he would sign. And he had a secretary there. I think his name was Peg. And it was like watching the Rockettes. I mean, there was a synchronicity to it where she slid something, he signed it, and she slid back with one hand and slid the next thing under. And it was an operation. And I would have went, you know, Arnold picked up the tab on all that mail. He signed everything. If you have an Arnold Palmer signature, it's probably not worth a lot because he signed everything. And that's an amazing testament to the man and the life he led and what his fans meant to him.
Yeah.
I love that Golf Channel special on Arnie. And one of the episodes is devoted to how he treated the fans and it's just amazing. And then he has the hospital in town. That's impacted a lot of people I know, having children there or children who are sick. So his reach, he's not here, but his reach certainly continues.
And that is a great thing to be able to say. You know, what am I going to give back? What is my legacy? His legacy is still giving.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the hospital meant a lot to him. He wasn't a guy just to put his name on something. He'd visit the kids. He knew the doctors. It's just Arnold Palmer. I mean, there just was no one else like him. There really wasn't. He
Yeah,
was the
totally
pattern.
agree. Totally agree. Jeff, thanks for sharing your thoughts and the memories and the history and your relationship with him. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it, Rich. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dottie Pepper with CBS Sports, and you are listening to the Back Nine
And welcome
Boys
back.
Golf Show.
I'm Rich Stiles. Our next guest is Chubby Chandler, former pro golfer for 15 years, turned sports agent who has worked with Darren Clark and with Rory McIlroy. Good morning, Chubby, and welcome to the show.
Morning, Rich. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. First question is, how did you get with Darren Clark way back when you started?
Well, I finished playing the tour in 1989, and I didn't want to be a golf professional that was going to sell tee pegs. I didn't know enough about the golf swing to be a coach. And I heard about a thing called PR, but I didn't know what it meant. but I sort of edged a bit that way. And when I was playing, I was fairly good at finding my own sponsors and creating I suppose we'd call it an activation package now, but he just did golf days and did anything to sort of help pay for the money you were getting. And I did some work for a man called Mike Parker, who worked for a huge British company called ICI. And funnily enough, I'm in South Africa now, and this started when I was in South Africa. And we worked with an old player called John Bland, who passed away last year. And we entertained his customers, and tournaments used to finish on a Saturday, and we'd play with them on a Sunday after we'd finished playing the tournament. And he came, this Mike Parker came back to England, and he said, I want to do the same thing now. He said, I'm working for ICI. He was he headed up ICI Colors and Dyes. And they had a lot of Japanese clients. And in those days, the Japanese guys all played golf. So there used to be sort of 15, 20 of them from Fuji, from Nikon, and they come over and we take them to a golf tournament, and I organized the program, and I found two players that were better than me that he could sponsor. And that was the start of my business. That first deal was the start of my business. And then I signed up a lot of guys that I played with, the likes of Richard Boxall, who's a commentator now, and Derek Cooper, who's a European Tour executive. So, you know, a lot of guys I played with. And then in August 1990, I got this call from a pal of mine who's an Irish lawyer and also an international golfer. And he said, there's a young guy over here who wants to meet with you and wants to have some advice whether to turn pro now or wait till 1991, which was the Walker Cup in Ireland, Port Arnold. Right. So I went over on spec to meet this young guy, Darren Clark. And he turned up in the middle of August in a cashmere boss overcoat and with long tinted hair. And you know, he looked the part. There was an air of confidence about the lad. And we talked for an hour, and I gave him all the reasons that I thought he should turn pro now. And he asked me lots of things about what I could do for him. And after an hour, he said, right, I just want to play golf. Can you do everything else? And well, I wasn't going to say no, and I wasn't going to say some of it. I said, of course, I can do everything else. And that's how we started. I actually started doing everything. You know, I paid his phone bill, I paid his electricity bill, booked his flights, paid his hotels, just did everything. And he was the start. And then after that, one or two more saw what was going on and that we'd done a good job. And because if you're a management company, the best thing you can do is put a logo on a player, because the other players see and they go, right. What's that? How did you get that?
Right.
So guys just say, well, Chubby got me that. So then quite quickly, we got lots of golfers. And what we were very good at was looking after the guys that were turning pro. So we could paint a picture of what the first 3 or 4 years should be like and how they should approach the tour school, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the start of it. And that was August 1990.
And you've worked with Darren for quite a long time. How cool was it for you to see him and be with him at the 2011 Open Championship that he won?
Yeah, that was probably the most emotional thing that ever happened. That and the first tee of the 2006 Ryder Cup, and both for the same reason, really.
Right.
Heather had passed away 3 or 4 weeks before the Ryder Cup in Ireland, and then obviously Heather was with him when he won the Open at St. George's, in his mind anyway.
All right, you had an opportunity also to work with a young man called Rory McIlroy, along with Louis Oosthuizen and Charles Schwartzel, besides Darren. How did you get together with Rory? Was it because of your success with Darren?
Well, Darren has a foundation, and the foundation for junior golfers in Ireland, and to give them opportunities, and he puts on a weekend every year for the top sort of 15 to 20 young golfers under 18 in Ireland. And actually about 2 weeks ago, he's just done one at Abaco in the Bahamas for 15 Irish kids. So they will have had the most amazing time for, I don't know what it was, 3 days this year, but you know, he eats with them, he plays with them, he goes on the range with them, he gives them everything he's got. And what the very first one he did, I went over to Port Marnock with him, and there was this little, tiny little guy called Rory McIlroy, who was 13 and playing off, I think, 3 handicap then. And you just knew he was different. You know, he was more confident than the rest. He was more talented than the rest. He asked more questions than the other guys. You know, he just stood out. And from that day on, I had a connection to the McIlroys and Dad, more Dad than Rory. You know,
right.
Dad used to ring me up for bits of advice. And in about 3 years later, when Rory was about 16, he had something like 88 colleges contacting him to get Rory to go to college in the States. And he got completely stressed out. And he said, I don't know what to do. He said, they're all coming at me. And he said, and what do you think? I said, well, I think he's too good. He should turn pro as soon as he played the Walker Cup in 2007, I think it was. And then we devised a plan for Jerry McIlroy to be able to say to anybody that called him up, because he was also getting management companies ringing him. And you know, he said, is it all right if I say we're going to sign with you and tell the colleges I'm going to turn pro and whatever? And I said, of course it is. And that'll make your life much easier. Because right. In those days, the PGA Tour have done a very clever thing with the college system now, where they integrate the good guys into the tour. Those days, my personal feeling was that there were certain amateurs too good to go to college in the States, because the standard wasn't high enough for them then. Now it's changed now. The standard's obviously much higher in the colleges. And I think that's why people like Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and people like that only went to college for a year, because they just wanted to go and sample college life and, you know, sort of have a few beers with the mates and see a few of the girls, and then they'd turn pro then. And
right.
Rory didn't need that. Rory was already good enough to just kick on. So he turned pro 2 days after the Walker Cup that year.
Well, that was obviously good advice. He's had a pretty good career, as has Darren. I've been reading, and you have been quoted as saying that you believe, or you've heard, that Rory is looking at an offer, or might be getting an offer from the LIV Tour for $950 million to join him.
Yeah, I'm not sure I said all that, but I said something like that.
Okay.
I haven't heard that he's doing it. My guess is the number has to be around there to make it interesting for him.
Right.
You know, if John Rahm was 600, then Rory's got to be 50% more. But my feeling there, and what I was reported as saying, was that if he signs with LIV, the rules will all change very quickly, because golf can't do without Rory McIlroy at the moment. You know, there's if there's no Tiger, and with respect to all the other golfers, the one guy that seems to attract all the attention is Rory McIlroy.
Right.
So if he goes to live, they're going to make a plan that he plays in the majors because they need him. You know, the CBS, NBC, all these television outlets don't want to put these tournaments on unless he's involved. So somebody somewhere is going to have to change all the rules. So to my way of thinking, Rory should take the cash because it's there. Right. And then they'll make all the rules that'll work for him. And they'll work for Rahm. We're only talking about 10 LIV players. We're not talking about 30 LIV players. We're talking about 10. And the major tournaments need them in it because you can't have majors without the best players in the world playing.
Right. So if he's offered that, your advice to him, if you were advising him, would be to take it. Do you think that the Masters is such a big tournament for him that if he is going to take it, that he would wait until after the Masters to do it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. But okay. I mean, at the end of the day, my advice would be to take it because it's an awful lot of money and a lot of McIlroy generations will be fixed for life. And that's a big thing, you know, sort of if he knows that his kids and his kids' kids are all looked after because he's playing golf in a different area, I think that's a pretty cool deal. The shame of it is that I'm not managing him and I could have got 10%.
Yeah, I know.
No, I'm seriously, the to me, the rules have changed a bit because of John Rahm. But Rory moves the needle more than John Rahm.
Right.
So if Rory went, then the needle, the whole landscape will change. And I think he had an unbelievably raw deal from the PGA Tour, who stuck him on a pedestal, stuck him into every press conference, let him take all the flak, and then changed all the rules without telling him. I think, you know, he's entitled to take the cash.
Yeah, he's kind of had the rug pulled out from him from the PGA Tour when he was their spokesman for so many months and years. I didn't agree with the way that happened. Do you think, Chubby, that the LIV Tour and the PGA Tour are going to have to decide and get together and try and figure out a way for some of the LIV players to come back to the tour?
I think they have to figure out a way that the good LIV players play the good PGA Tour events, because I've just, funnily enough, you've caught me at a good time, because I'm in South Africa now and I've been watching LIV in Jeddah. And I'm probably going to put the Cognizant on for half an hour later. There's a lot of very good players and very well-known players playing in Jeddah. And there's Rory McIlroy playing in West Palm Beach, in Palm Beach Gardens. And the contrast is amazing because LIV now probably have, I don't know, 25 household names, even 30 household names, people that everybody can relate to. And yet, you know, I watched the PGA Tour last night, and great, they're making a great story of Knapp winning last week. And it was a great story. But it's not quite like watching Brooks Koepka.
Good point.
But I think they've got to come together.
Yeah, I think eventually they're going to have to figure out a way. All right, I've got about 3 minutes left. Let me just ask you this. Do you think, let's go back a couple of years. Do you think when LIV started, do you believe that the PGA Tour handled it correctly? And maybe if they would have sat down then, rather than saying, we don't even want to be with you, that it might have turned out a little differently for everyone?
I think one of the whole causes of the problem was Jay Monahan being arrogant enough to think that he didn't need to take a meeting with a potential sponsor with $2 billion and to say no before he knew what was even going to be discussed. And I think he's unbelievably irresponsible. I have no idea how he's still got a job, because to me, he's let down two halves of his organization. He's let down the guys that have gone to LIV, and he's let down the guys that haven't gone to LIV. And if somebody had had decent conversations 2 years ago, this might never have happened. Yeah. And I was part of an impromptu meeting at the Open at St. George's with Sam McNaughton, who looks after Ricky Fowler, and Keith Pelly, who's the boss of the PP World Tour. And they'd had a couple of vodkas on it, I think, and Sam kept hitting the table and just say, take the meeting, take the meeting.
Right.
And he said, these people have got $2 billion to put into the game. We cannot afford not to be talking to them. And nobody ever talked to them.
Obviously, it was mishandled.
Terribly. And I think I think it was a shame that the European Tour did their tie-in with the PGA Tour at the time they did, because if the timing had been different and the DP World could have gone with LIV and done what they're doing, then that could have been different too. Because you get these international series events now on the Asian Tour, and you get 25 LIV players playing. So imagine if it had been the European Tour. Imagine if it was the BMW at Wentworth. You get 25 extra really good players playing.
Very good point. Well-known names, as we can say. Former major champions.
Absolutely.
It'll be interesting over the next few months what'll happen. Chubby, I can't thank you enough. I know we had a little trouble getting together, but man, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Rich. Talk to you again sometime.
You've been listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show with Rich Stiles. Go to back9boys.com for all things golf whenever you want it. We'll be back next week with an all-new Back Nine Boys at back9boys.com.
A t-shirt and jeans. Mac and cheese. Oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at schwabious.com.